DiscerningHearts.com, and Spirit Catholic Radio, in cooperation with the Pope Paul VI Institute, presents Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. Dr. Hilgers, after being deeply touched by the teachings of Pope Paul VI's encyclical Humanae Vitae, founded the Pope Paul VI Institute for the Study of Human Reproduction in Omaha, Nebraska. Dr. Hilgers, along with his co-workers, developed the Creighton Model Fertility Care System. He would go on to discover NAPRO technology. In 1994, Pope John Paul II appointed him to full membership in the Pontifical Academy for Life. And with his wife Susan, Dr. Hilgers serves on the Pontifical Council for the Family. Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. One area in particular that is, as you have termed it, a national tragedy, and that's prematurity.
The prematurity rate in the United States has almost doubled in the last 30 or 40 years.
Wow.
In the mid-1960s, the prematurity rate in the United States was 6.7%. And in 2003, roughly the last year we have good statistics for, was about 12.1 or 12.2%.
There's nothing more frightening for a woman, or dare I say a couple, than to be experiencing those pains of a potential labor pains,
yeah,
or that you may have spotting way before the due date.
That's right. And a lot of times what happens, if they're not contractions that are actually putting her in labor at that moment, the doctor will say you have what we call false labor pains or Braxton Hicks contractions.
Mm-hmm.
In order to manage and prevent prematurity, you have to take the term Braxton Hicks and remove it from your vocabulary. Because a premature birth at, say, 32 weeks actually begins its process at about 18 or 20 weeks. So it's a 8 or 10 or 15 week period in advance of the actual birth of the child that the symptoms and the process that eventually leads to the premature birth is ongoing. So if you can find this condition, identify it early enough in pregnancy, then you can intervene directly on its solution, and you can have a full-term pregnancy without really very much difficulty.
How does NAPRO technology play a role in helping to prevent premature birth?
Well, NAPRO technology, that's a good question. See, here's how it kind of runs with NAPRO technology. With our patients with infertility and repetitive miscarriages, we've used a lot of progesterone to help support that post-ovulatory phase of the cycle. Then when they become pregnant, we give them progesterone during the course of pregnancy. I've been using progesterone since 1979 in my patients, my high-risk patients with these types of reproductive backgrounds. And we actually own the largest series of patients any place in the world of patients who have delivered after receiving progesterone therapy. And we found that by giving progesterone, it reduced the risk of premature birth. Now, a couple, three, 4 years ago, there was a big splash made because there were a couple of studies that showed that progesterone reduced premature birth. And we had been doing this ourselves for, well, at that time, for almost 25 years. And there was data in the medical literature in the 1960s and the 1970s that showed that progesterone helped quiet uterine contractions and help prevent premature birth. So it wasn't anything new to us. And in fact, it wasn't anything new to medicine as a whole, perinatal medicine as a whole. But it was ignored like so many things in medicine. And I think in part because they were using natural hormones, and for whatever reason, there continues to be that sort of almost a prejudice against natural hormones. But because of our interest in preventing, particularly preventing a miscarriage, we were interested in supplementing the pregnancy with progesterone. Then we started measuring the hormone levels during the pregnancy, the progesterone levels, and we began to realize that the most important time in pregnancy to receive progesterone was in the second and the third trimesters of pregnancy and not in the first trimester. Now, that's a huge paradigm shift. The medical profession to this day believes that progesterone is important in the first trimester of pregnancy, but after that, you don't need progesterone. In fact, it should be discontinued. Now, if you were to ask people what evidence they would base that upon, they could not produce you that evidence because that evidence does not exist. There is evidence to show that the placenta takes over the production of progesterone by the second trimester of the pregnancy. Mm-hmm. But there is no evidence that it takes over completely. And there is no evidence that suggests that you should not give progesterone in the second and the third trimesters of pregnancy. That's just one of those things that over many, many years we've just accepted as like the gospel truth. And yet it has gone by without any critical thinking or critical questioning. So in our studies, we have something like 15,000 blood levels of progesterone in well over 1,000 pregnancies that we've evaluated, and we have found, to our satisfaction at least, that progesterone is most helpful in the second and third trimesters of pregnancy, which is exactly the opposite of what everybody says and what everybody thinks. So it's a huge paradigm shift, and when you have those in any profession, it's going to take a while for people to grab a hold of that. So progesterone therapy, which came to us because of NAPRO technology, was then implemented in pregnancy and found to be helpful. It was, however, not the only thing that helped, but it was one of the major things that did help prevent prematurity.
And what is the prematurity rate from not only the Pope Paul VI Institute, but do you have studies from other practitioners that use the information that you have from the Pope Paul VI Institute?
Well, we don't. We have a number of places around the country who have used progesterone, but we haven't we don't have the funding available to be able to do that type of study yet. However, one of the things that we will probably be able to do in the next couple of years is settle the issue of whether or not progesterone is safe to be used in pregnancy. Now, as I mentioned, we've treated over 1,000 pregnancies with progesterone, and we can show, I think, definitively that progesterone is safe in pregnancy. And if you take all the other studies that have been done over 20 or 30 years that don't even add up to the number that we have, there's absolutely no evidence in any of those studies that progesterone does any harm. And as a result, I think we'll be able to definitively say that progesterone in pregnancy is safe. Now, that's a big issue. It's a big issue because of the DES scare. When diethylstilbestrol was given 40 or 50 years ago to women to help prevent miscarriage, they found out later that it caused problems in both the baby girls and the baby boys. And so there's been a huge reluctance to give anything in pregnancy. Certainly any hormonal therapy, even if it was a naturally occurring hormone. But it wasn't too much of a leap of faith because we were talking about a naturally occurring hormone, progesterone, which is produced in large quantities during pregnancy. And when you look at DES, diethylstilbestrol, that was as different from estrogen as grease is from water. I mean, it's that sharply different and should never have been given in pregnancy if anybody had used sort of their brain trying to figure out what could or could not be used. That would not be a good choice. But progesterone is, I mean, literally, the babies are bathing in progesterone. And so to give progesterone as a supportive hormone is absolutely not harmful to them. But it does help, amongst other things, does help prevent premature birth.
You also mentioned about the possibility of low-grade infections and treating that. What has your study shown as far as the reduction of contractions and things like that after the treatment that you give for that?
Well, in about 1985, I had a patient who had begun to have these, what we then called Braxton-Hicks contractions. Mm-hmm. She was about 24, 25 weeks pregnant at the time, and I was concerned about it. And I talked to one of the perinatologists, and I asked him whether or not he thought this could be due to infection. He says, yeah, he thought so. And I said, well, what would we treat him with? And he said, well, I don't know. I've never treated him. And he gave me an idea that another perinatologist had given to him but had never used, and that was to give an antibiotic and to pulse it, given it every 2 or 3 days, all the way through the rest of the pregnancy. I didn't have enough guts to give it to that patient because it was new in my mind. I didn't even know what antibiotic to choose because it had never been done before. And sure enough, she ruptured her membranes at about 30 weeks and delivered her baby at about 32 weeks. So that was not a good example and not a good outcome as far as I was concerned. So the next patient that I saw with this was a patient who had delivered one baby prematurely earlier in her life, and that baby had cerebral palsy. So she began having all of these symptoms of Braxton-Hicks contractions, low backache, pelvic pressure, cramping, uterus sort of knotting up into a ball, increased vaginal discharge, all of these things. but she wasn't technically in labor. So I had a talk with her, and I said, look, by this time I decided what antibiotic I was going to try, and I had a long talk with her about possibly being able to prevent this, but I didn't know for certain, but the antibiotic I was choosing, if I gave it, would not do harm to her or her baby. So she said, look, I don't want to risk another baby born with cerebral palsy, and I would be happy to look at a treatment like this. So we implemented the treatment. We gave her the intravenous antibiotics, and within 24 to 48 hours, all of her contractions, her pelvic pressure, her cramps, all of the things that were leading us to be suspicious in this all disappeared. And we were able to give this, in that case, all the way up to about 37 weeks, and she delivered it full term, a perfectly healthy, normal baby. The second patient that I had was a woman who ruptured her membranes when she was 16 weeks pregnant. And I have never had anybody rupture their membranes at 16 weeks of pregnancy. And it carries with it a lot of different risks. But we put her on the same antibiotic protocol. She continued to leak fluid the rest of her pregnancy, but delivered at 38 weeks, a perfectly healthy boy who is now 20 years old or something like that and doing just great. And so we began to gain a little bit of momentum with this and began to implement this as a therapy, as one of the things that we would use in the prevention of premature birth. And now that we have 20-some years experience with this, the only reason this could be working is because there's a low-grade infection. And there was a study done in 1984 that, again, was pretty much ignored by the medical profession, but suggested that this might be the case. And it was based on that study that I implemented this treatment program. What we do know is that this is an organism that's sort of hidden. It's what we call a silent chorioamnionitis, which is an infection that doesn't have rip-roaring symptoms. You don't get a high fever. You don't get a elevated white blood count. You don't get a real tender uterus. The sorts of things we've all been taught over the years are associated with this. It's much more subtle than that. You have to pay attention to the subtleties. But when they're there, then we implement this strategy. And it almost universally, certainly 90% of the time, within days, all the symptoms disappear and they go to full term. So that's the evidence that we have that there's a low-grade infection, which most likely is related to this whole sexual promiscuity and this whole sexually transmitted disease era that we're living in. And sexually transmitted diseases aren't all just gonorrhea and chlamydia and human papillomavirus. Some of them are E. coli. Some of them are various types of streptococcus infections and so forth. There's a lot of just common everyday bacteria that are sexually transmitted as well. And so these women actually carry these organisms in a way that they have, well, virtually no symptoms. And then once they become pregnant at about the 18th or 20th or 22nd or 24th week, they start showing up with these symptoms. Now we're finding that when we look at the Creighton model charts of these same women before they ever got pregnant, that there are signs on those charts that give us some hint as to that the presence of this infection that we didn't know. And we haven't studied this very thoroughly yet. That's a project for the next couple of years. But if that's the case, and we can look at one of these charts and say there's an infection there for certain, then we can say you should get that treated before you ever get pregnant. And then we're probably the best of all worlds. We could eliminate the problem right at the start.
There was a study in Britain that came out and showed a correlation between the rise in prematurity rate and the number of abortions that occur in Britain. And it was interesting that as the abortions rose, so did the prematurity rate.
Well, there's no question that abortion is associated with an increased prematurity rate, especially first trimester abortions where they have to forcibly dilate the cervix. It causes a disruption in the function of the cervix. It causes a weakening in the cervix, and some of these babies are subsequently born prematurely. And you know what? This is not a new thing. This is what's so frustrating about all of this. This has also been shown here in the United States. But what's even more so is this was shown in the Eastern Bloc companies before Roe versus Wade. I wrote, as a young resident in obstetrics and gynecology, I wrote the medical portion of an amicus brief, which was submitted to the U.S. Supreme Court in Roe versus Wade. And I outlined all of the medical complications that could be observed to our knowledge at that time, 1972 to 73, when that was submitted. I outlined all the complications, and one of the complications was increased prematurity, and it was a significant increase. I mean, it went almost identical to what we're talking about, from 6 to 12%. Now, that's one of the reasons, too, why we have an increase in the prematurity rate, but it's not the only reason My whole point is that information went to the United States Supreme Court and a friend of the court brief, and they just ignored it. The other thing they ignored, incidentally, which was a part of that brief, which I didn't write, but a medical friend of mine did write, was one of the best and well-documented discussions of prenatal growth and development in the unborn that I've ever seen written. And so they did have this information before they made their final decision on Roe versus Wade. But again, they ignored it because of political reasons and because of preconceived philosophical persuasions. I'm absolutely convinced that Justice Blackmun was pro-abortion before he ever wrote that argument. And because it's such a poorly written argument, he was pulling at this and pulling at that. He was just pulling from all different sources to try to put together an argument in favor of abortion, something that would fit his philosophical pretext. The decision reads like it was thrown together like that.
It's just yet another tragedy from the whole abortion culture, because as you described in earlier segments, exactly what is done not only in a first trimester abortion, but also what needs to be done in a second trimester abortion and third, that type of assault inside the womb, it's bound to have an effect on the ability right. of it to heal and to be able to function properly in the future.
Well, yeah, and some of these are physically quite damaging, and they lead not only to an increased prematurity rate, but to an increased miscarriage rate, increase in the number of stillbirths, placental abnormalities in subsequent pregnancies, like a placenta previa, where the placenta is over the opening of the uterus, the outflow of the uterus. So there's a lot of long-term side effects to abortion that have, for the most part, been ignored over the years. I think conveniently so, because, frankly, all those people who've supported it aren't quite willing to say that my support has led to this mm-hmm. particular condition or this particular set of circumstances, which are adverse.
So instead of acknowledging the cause and relation to the prematurity rate, not just for abortions, but also promiscuous behavior, other things that might lead to, other devices using an IUD could affect the inside of the woman's uterus mm-hmm. and have complications down the road. Instead of acknowledging that, its specialties are rising up to treat the symptoms of this particular behavior instead of solving the problem yeah, so right, you don't need right. to have that.
Well, it's all after the fact.
Yes.
Instead of before the fact. Instead of looking at the relationship between this behavior and that outcome, so they want to intervene after the behavior because they'll allow the behavior. Why not intervene before the behavior even occurs, because the behavior is at the root cause of the problem, in this case, abortion and prematurity.
When a woman is experiencing uterine contractions earlier in her pregnancy, and this is not the time for the baby to come, there is a sense of panic that can come in. And yet with NAPRO technology and the work of Pope Paul VI, it's a source of education for the woman so that they can become a part of the treatment. And I would imagine even with those with high-risk pregnancies, that educational component is still an important factor.
Well, it is a very important factor. In fact, one of the things we do with all of our women who are pregnant as they enter into the second trimester of their pregnancy is we teach them the markers of things they're supposed to be paying attention to. A lot of times you'll ask somebody, do you have low backache? They say yes. Do you have pelvic pressure? They say yes. Does your uterus sort of knot up like a ball? And they say yes. And I said, do you know that you're having contractions? Oh, no, I didn't know that. I thought contractions were contractions, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that's understandable. But if they're not educated on that, then they won't know enough to call us. I always tell our patients that I only see you once a month during your prenatal care, the middle of the prenatal care especially. Near the end, we see patients more frequently, but since we only see you every month, once a month, I want you to call if you have any of these symptoms, because they will occur at some point when I'm not actually seeing you.
Mm-hmm.
Then we can intervene. And our nurses are all trained to pick up on these calls. And we're very, very good at it. We're so good at it that we've treated people by long distance with some of our prematurity prevention protocols because they couldn't get any cooperation locally for any of their concerns. And the protocols work just as well by long distance as they do when they're right here in Omaha.
It truly is fertility care to be able to offer that, especially for someone who has had children who have been born prematurely, or they've miscarried, or they've experienced, again, so many of those other unfortunate outcomes that come from not having a situation treated properly.
Yeah.
I mean, it really offers hope, and it's a sense of control, too, that you're not helpless. You're not just sitting back and waiting for something to happen.
Well, that's true. There's another technique that we use in preventing prematurity, too, and it's called a cervical cerclage. This is a stitch that's put in the cervix like a purse string, and it's pulled tight, and it holds the cervix closed during the course of the pregnancy. Now, if you're in rip-roaring labor, you don't want to put a cerclage in because it's just going to rip the cervix. But if you're in a situation way before that time and you put a cerclage in, you could help a person get to full term along with the other things that we utilize very nicely. It's the least used of all of our techniques, but it's also a very good one when we use it properly. We can now evaluate the cervix by ultrasound. We're very specific about the criteria with which we use it, and it's a very important additional technique that we can use to help prevent a preterm birth. So it's pretty amazing. But then again, cerclage is another one of these procedures where the medical profession has pretty much said it's not any good or not worthwhile. And this is based on studies that have been methodologically flawed, that are not adequate to actually answer the question that they're looking for. One of the first of these studies was a group of women where they see, if you do a randomized controlled trial, which means you've got two groups of people, but you randomly give them the treatment so you don't know which is which, mm-hmm. kind of thing, that's supposed to be the best study design of any. But a randomized controlled trial, which has a basically flawed study design to begin with, doesn't solve the flawed study design. So what they did is they took two groups of patients. One group, they put a cerclage in, the other group, they didn't. And at the end of the study, and they randomized this, at the end of the study, they decided the data showed that the women in the cerclage group had actually more adverse outcome measurements than the women who didn't have a cerclage. Okay, so based on that, you'd say, well, the cerclage isn't very helpful because a cerclage is actually causing more problems than it's helping. But then when you look closely at the study design, any woman who had a short cervix, any woman who had had previous surgery on her cervix, any woman who had had a previous premature birth, any woman who had had a multiple pregnancy, and the list goes on and on and on, were excluded from the study because they felt that group definitely needed cerclages. Well, what they basically did in their study was, but they didn't own up to this, of course, is they said, they didn't say this, but this is the true conclusion of the study, is that if you put a cerclage into a pregnant woman who does not need one, you're going to expect more abnormal outcomes in that group of patients than if you just leave them alone, which you don't have to be a brain surgeon to figure that one out.
And so they left out the people, the high risk, the ones who actually need it. They didn't even place that in the study.
No. Well, they didn't. And the reason they didn't, because they viewed it as unethical, because they know a cerclage will help that population of patients. The biggest thing with a cerclage is that it has to be given with antibiotics. In other words, you have to give the patient a broad-spectrum antibiotic for about 3 days around the time you get the cerclage, because many of these changes of the cervix are due to these low-grade infections. So if you don't do that, you're going to have bad outcomes. But if you do that, you'll have excellent outcomes. And there's been no study of cervical cerclages that has done that except our own. And we've done that for a very long period of time now and had excellent results with it.
Oh, well, we're extraordinarily happy and blessed that there are neonatologists and staff who can help support these newborn infants that have come so early into the world.
And I want to make it clear that a good neonatal intensive care unit and a good set of neonatologists is really, really tremendous. And they do tremendous things. We're never going to eliminate prematurity, mm-hmm. but we should be able to decrease it significantly. And so there will always be a need for these units and these doctors. However, there's also become a sort of a mentality within obstetrics that if a woman is at, well, let's say 31 to 32, 33 weeks in that range right there, and she's in premature labor or threatening to go into premature labor, that the doctor will say, well, it's okay if she delivers because that she can go to the neonatal nursery and do very well. Generally speaking, they do well. But there's also data to show absolutely convincingly that they do not do as well as if they go to 37 weeks. So in the mother's womb is the mantra of the day. They have to stay inside the mother's womb. That's the best incubator that there is. And it's not a black mark on the neonatologists at all. It's just a challenge to us as obstetricians to be able to see that this gets done. And it can be done, and it could be done now, today, even though I'm sure we can find better ways perhaps in the future and maybe sort of improved ways. Right now, we can actually do it.
And as you pointed out, there may be effects that are beyond the woman's control for future pregnancies to be able to prevent prematurity. But there are also, there's the onus on women on behavior prior to the conception of children. Are you engaging in a high-risk behavior that down the road may have consequences that you may not appreciate at this time?
I'm a huge believer that women have to take charge in this area. They have to demand of the public that they are the nurturers of life, that the public and the individual should respect them as whole people, and they should respect their biology and should respect their fertility and should respect their sexuality. And we've got to encourage women to speak up and be a part of strengthening their position, their real position in the culture, as the nurturers of life, the individuals who carry new human beings into this world and who need to be respected for that. Right now, I think, and I have no qualms at all by saying that we are a fertility-abusing society. And so long as we continue to be in a fertility-abusing mode, we have a lot of work to do to try to undercut that and to change the attitude or the paradigm when it comes to that.
Paul VI himself put the onus also on men to be able to rise to the level of what they were called as the patriarch of not only their families, but the protectors of the females, and to honor females in a way that both benefit. Because when the women suffer like this and the children suffer like this, men suffer as well.
That's for sure. And one of the things that I just picked up the other day as I was reading it is that he said very specifically that he felt that men of our day should have no difficulty adapting to this type of behavior. Actually, I totally agree with him. Men just need to be encouraged. A lot of times men find this stuff a lot more interesting almost than the women do, because to them, to the man, it's completely foreign. To the woman, she experiences these things month after month and so forth, and maybe doesn't have the interest, although I think they should have. Don't misunderstand me. But mm-hmm. A lot of times the men are acutely interested in this. And once they learn about it, they're very interested in being supportive and working together with it. There's a lot of paradigm shifts here we have to work on, but we'll get there.
Thank you so much, Dr. Helgers, you and your staff for leading the way on these important causes.
Thanks, Chris.
You've been listening to Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Helgers. To hear and or to download this episode, along with many others, go to discerninghearts.com. To learn more about the work of Dr. Helgers and the Pope Paul VI Institute, go to popepaulvi.com. This has been a production of discerninghearts.com, Spirit Catholic Radio, and the Pope Paul VI Institute. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join us next time for Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Helgers.